Okay, we're going to call the meeting to order in just a minute here. I'd like to have the folks from the Minnesota Family, Career, and Community Leaders of America, Wendy Ambrose, Monique Sabby, and Heidi Aninga, come down to the table. That I will call to order the meeting of the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. Members, this is a tough time of the day for our members because we know several other committees are going on. We're facing our first policy deadline, so people are going to be in and out. And I know for the members, they are juggling several meetings. We will first on the agenda have the Minnesota Family, Career, and Community Leaders of America. And then we will have the School Readiness Connections Pilot Project Final Evaluation. Then we will have the St. Paul Early Childhood Scholarship Program Evaluation Implementation Year 2. And last, we will have the Pre-Kindergarten Allowances Project Evaluation. I think we're going to do those two together, so I will be bringing them up at the same time. Well, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Wendy Ambrose. I'm the Executive Director of Family, Career, Community Leaders of America in Minnesota. And
I'm Heidi Anningay. And I'm Monique Sabey. I'm here representing Centennial High School as well as MAFCS.
It's good to see the students here today. Is there up here, if you want to raise your hands, thank you for coming. So you've all been here all day. It's part of your day in the Capitol. We appreciate that and for you hanging in here till 4:30 for our hearing. If you want to start with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, and the members of the committee for this opportunity to speak with you today. We represent the secondary level or high school, junior high level of family, career, community, leaders of America, but also the courses and the classes in family consumer science that deal with child development and parenting. And so for that reason, and a national certification test that's being developed, that may be of interest to you. As you probably know, the family consumer science areas of study cover 16 different areas of study, and the national standards document is in your packet. And of particular interest to this committee would be the standards for early childhood and the standards for human development and the standards for parenting of those 16, three of them especially. This helps prepare young people for their family career skills, but also for possibly a job working in education or early childhood in the future, or child psychology. And they would be pre-professional skills or foundational skills for those types of careers. Recently, the Career Builders and CNN had an article that listed the top 10 areas that people should seek for a potential college career. And number one on the list was the family consumer sciences area. And the reason it was listed there was because it's so adaptable to a broad range of skills and it can be transferable skills. Recently, FCCLA has been involved in helping a national coalition develop an early childhood certification test. And this test has become available as of December 2009, so it's really very new, for teachers and students in the high school level after a program of study to take a test that would deem that they have competencies in early childhood content area. And this test has been psychometrically sound and developed by a panel of business and industry and experts from around the nation. It is also going to help teachers assist students with a seamless transition from high school into college courses and perhaps save some time or resources so that they don't have to duplicate their course again. It would also guide teachers to improve their instruction as they see the scores that students might get. FCCLA has contributed financially to this this coalition in order that Minnesota students would get a price break for the test in the future. So because of that, students' tests will cost less. And these tests are available on the national website for American Association of Family Consumer Sciences, AAFCS, and teachers now are becoming aware of it as a tool for themselves. It will help satisfy the assessment and accountability requests for secondary and post-secondary education that are requirements of the Perkins federal legislation for career and technical education, and also satisfy the growing emphasis on credentials as a human resource and a quality control issue for employment tools in the future. So if you have questions about this national certification, we would offer you to ask those at the end. And Heidi's going to be explaining about FCCLA in a little bit and the connections with some project-based learning that we have in FCCLA. And there are several family consumer science teachers and advisors in the room. If you would just raise your hand, as I say, Marcine Elder from Fulda, Cindy Cole from Wadena Deer Creek, Julie Rick from Litchfield, Cindy Lagash from Goodhue, and Jans from Jordan, Childa Shottish from Clinton Graceville Beardsley, and Monique Savvy from Centennial, and Margie Berg from Pine Island. And they've been with us today as the students had excellent opportunities to shadow and observe a lot of the civic engagement opportunities going on here today. So we'd like to hear from Monique now.
Great, thank you. And you need to, again, state your name for the record before
That's
you
all
speak.
Right. So. I am Monique Savvy, and I am from Centennial High School. I teach child development classes at the senior high at Centennial. In my classes, students will learn the foundation of child development through theory, as well as apply this knowledge that they have learned, as well as positive guidance and developmentally appropriate practice through our student-run play school, where we actually have our 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds from the community come into our classroom. As a result of taking my child development classes, students have the opportunity to also obtain college credit through the articulation process in my classes. The classes or the schools that I articulate with are Century College and St. Paul College. Other 4-year schools have also accepted these credits. We know of schools such as Hamline, Iowa State, Stout, and other Wisconsin schools, 4-year schools, have accepted those. A little background about a student of mine, one of my close students, Amanda. She currently is enrolled in a program at North Dakota State University. She told me as a result of taking these child development classes, she was inspired to work with children. She felt that with the knowledge and training she had in class, she had a great background in doing this. So, as I said, she's currently enrolled and going to obtain a degree in child psychology. I feel like her story is very common for my students that I have in class through my coursework that I feel is very rigorous and relevant to the field of child psychology, that I play an important role in educating future teachers, child care providers, as well as parents in working with their children.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
I am Heidi Enninge, and I am a senior and a past state officer of FCCLA. Family, Career, and Community Leaders of America, or FCCLA, is a career and technical student organization with family as its central focus. We would like you to hear from some of the students who have participated in Minnesota FCCLA STAR events in the child development categories. Students can also participate in FCCLA HERO at their conference, which is for occupational family consumer science students. FCCLA has many state and national programs, including financial fitness, student body, Families First, Power of One, Community Service, Stop the Violence, Career Connection, Families Acting for Community Traffic Safety, and one of the most popular with all of our students is STAR Events. STAR Events stands for Students Taking Action with Recognition, and we have 44 categories of competition, and in these competition categories there are over 1,100 students and 860 presentations that go on during our state conference from April 15th to the 17th that will happen this year, 2010, and they will be selected with their competition to gain bronze, silver, and gold medals, and also have the chance to advance to the national competition, which will be held in July. The categories of STAR events, that competition that deal with child development, are Focus on Children, a project involving children, Illustrated Talks, and this would include Food for Kids and Positive Schools and Communities, Teach and Train, and its event is an event about becoming a future teacher, as well as early childhood, and this is an occupational event. I've also participated through my experiences in FCCLA in a curriculum called Protecting You, Protecting Me, which teaches teens to be peer educators for children. And as a part of this curriculum, this was to learn about the latest research in brain development. PYPM, which is short for Protecting You, Protecting Me, helps reach children before they have fully shaped their attitudes and opinions about alcohol use by youth and their role in preventing it. And this curriculum focuses on the effects of alcohol on the developing brain during the first 21 years of life. The lessons reinforce the fact that the brains of children and adolescents are still maturing and respond to alcohol dramatically different than adults' brains, putting the children at a much higher risk. The curriculum provides a series of 40 lessons, 8 lessons for each grade, first grade through fifth grade, and FCCLA helped to bring this curriculum to Minnesota for professional development teachers, and it helped me to learn about brain development in children and teens. We want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and all these opportunities are here because of Family Consumer Sciences Education and FCCLA. And if you have any questions for either of us, or we could have someone else answer the questions, we would be happy to try to answer them at this time.
Thank you. I know that I saw a lot of students all over the Capitol today, and we even had some students on the House floor while we were in session today. So we appreciate you visiting with us and being here. I had talked with Wendy Ambrose, your director, about coming here, and we appreciate you testifying. I'll just ask a question, and then we probably have to go on to our next testifiers. Mm-hmm. But so you're from Fulda,
yep.
Right? Two quick questions. Do you know Ted Winter? He's a former state legislator.
Yeah.
Maybe some of you know him.
He lives just down the road.
Does he? Well, I served with him, and he was great. So tell him hello from Nora. And also, tell me how this program has changed your life.
Well, I'll just be pretty brief with this, and I'll give you my standard story about me as a child.
Okay.
If my sister's back there and she could tell you the same thing, she was always the brave one. She would be the one to go up to the buffet people and ask for a plate because I was too shy to. I never talked on the phone. I just really didn't have a goal of being a person who would stand up and talk about something or advocate for something. And my role in this has just been to make a difference in my own life and in the life of just everyone around me, and I've had so many opportunities through my family consumer sciences classes. I as I mentioned, I had the chance to teach Protecting You, Protecting Me to first graders, and these first graders had never heard anything like what I was telling them. Mm. And even first graders were telling me just really personal stories about their own experiences with alcohol, and I knew that what I was doing was relevant and it was going to make a difference in their lives. But that's just one example of what I've gotten to do through Family Consumer Sciences and FCCLA. I have been a region officer, state officer, and a national candidate for office, and just those opportunities have brought me to places like this where I have an opportunity to speak about what I feel is important. Which is the skills that students across the nation are getting in family consumer sciences classes that they're not getting anywhere else.
Good. Well, thank you for being here today and for sharing that. I have a couple teenagers, and I have not heard of this program before. I think it is really good and giving you, it's probably hard to know now, but for all of you, this is going to further you in your lives, in your college experiences, and maybe you'll wind up, if you want to be, behind one of these chairs or in the desk someday if you want to be elected. It helps to get out there at a young age. So thank you for being here, and keep in touch with us.
Thank you.
Next, we have the School Readiness Connections Pilot Project Final Evaluation. Cherie Kotelnik, Lori Hosen, and Kristen Vosberg. And thanks to... And we have a quorum, so we can do the minutes. Representative Bly.
Having looked at the minutes, Chair Slawik, I would recommend moving them.
Thank you. Representative Bly moves approval of the minutes of March 2nd. Any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes for March 2nd are approved. Welcome to the committee. You're back again, Ms. Katulnik, right?
I am.
Twice in 1 week.
Madam Chair.
If you would like to introduce your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Cherie Katulnik, and I manage the Child Care Assistance Program for the Department of Human Services. And I am pleased, proud, and happy to be here to talk about the School Readiness Connections Project and the evaluation from the first biennium of this project. Just a little reminder, this School Readiness Connection Project is a pilot project that builds from the existing Child Care Assistance Program infrastructure. It targets high-quality services to children from low-income families, and those are families with characteristics that have been shown to be connected to children who are not ready for school. And it's built in a way that makes allowable use of CCDF funding to support parents' employment and the children's ability to be ready for school. So it's a dual-purpose outcome goal. The School Readiness Connections Project is a child care assistance program pilot project. It was initially funded for 2 years in 2007 to 2009. It served 364 children during that time, ages 0 to 5, over a 19-month period. And $1 million was appropriated as a capped allocation for this project. The evaluation that you're going to hear about covers the first biennium of the project. In the last session, you did appropriate $1.4 million in direct services to continue this project for another 2 years with the existing providers and families. The goals of SRC were to create incentives for high-quality child care programs to provide services to child care assistance program children that support the children's school readiness. And the high quality this program was started before the Parent Aware Project, so the high quality was determined based on an RFP and an application process, and Lori will tell you a little bit more about the criteria for that. The other goal was to create incentives for families receiving child care assistance to choose these programs for their children.
Do we, Ms. Katulnik, we have an extensive report, right,
mm-hmm.
from SRI did the evaluation?
Yes, SRI did the evaluation, and you also have a short version of the report from them. And then I believe there was a PowerPoint in your packet and a map.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The key features of the School Readiness Connections Project is, and you'll maybe remember some of these things from the Administrative Simplification Task Force recommendations. They pay selected programs up to 25% higher than current CCAP statute allows. They suspend some of the CCAP policies that interrupt continuity of care. And one of those is that the weekly child care authorization can continue even if the parents' approved activities change, as long as one parent was eligible for at least 35 hours of service in the beginning of the project. So if that decreases or changes over the project, the child can still continue. The absent day limits do not apply to SRC children, so the continuity of care is supported in that way. Children are required to attend at least 25 hours per week if the parent remains eligible for child care assistance, and the providers have to offer full day, full year services. So that's just the basic background again of SRC, and I'm going to pass it on to Lori Pocine to talk to you about the evaluation results.
Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Hi, I'm Lori Pocine, and I work in the Child Care Assistance Program at Department of Human Services.
So if you could move towards the microphone, we're recording, so
I'm
we just
sorry.
Want to make sure.
Scoot over a little bit.
Get your voice okay.
Should
Thank
I do
you.
That again?
Okay.
Again, this is Lori Pocine with Department of Human Services, and I just want to point out, Sri briefly went over the differences between regular SRC regular CCAP policies and school readiness connection policies. And on page 6 of the full report, there's a nice chart that charts out what those differences are. And you may just want to note that either for now or later. It's more important probably for later when you're referring back to it. So SRC was a program that selected child care providers who were already serving CCAP children. And so the families that participated were programs by, at least at the beginning, the programs were serving children already in their child care program who were already eligible for CCAP. About 270 families were served over this 19-month period of the first biennium, and the average household income was just over $18,000 a year. During the evaluation, we pulled data from county files as well as interviewed families, and we interviewed providers. We had data from multiple methods to find out more about what was happening during the SRC project. So we found that most parents were working, which is not a surprise because most families on CCAP are working. So just over 83% of the families on SRC were working families, and the remaining just over 20% were either in school or some kind of employment support program or perhaps some job search during the time that they got SRC. The children that we studied over the 19-month period of time averaged 36 weeks of attendance during that 19-month period. But children came and left during different points in time, but that was just the average. So I'll talk a little bit about how the programs were selected. As Sheree mentioned, there was an application process, and kudos to those providers who did that. The legislation passed in May. We had an application ready by August, and programs applied in September and were chosen in October, and we had agreements in place in November and kids authorized in December. So I just want to say it was it went well, but it was a fast track. And so programs that responded to the RFP, there were 41 who actually submitted the full application, and because, again, of the limited funds, we were able to select 14 programs to serve the 364 children. The first priority of those applications went to programs that served at least 25% CCAP children, because one of the goals of the legislation was to target kids on CCAP. We worked during the application review process to make our criteria align with the parent-aware criteria that was then being developed. So we worked closely with the other DHS staff and made sure that our criteria matched how parent-aware was being planned. And so I do also want to mention that in Appendix B of the report, we did do a comparison of the SRC criteria, the parent-aware criteria, and also what the results were and how they did compare. So at a later time, that might be interesting to you. One difference is that in Parent Aware, programs get an on-site assessment during to be rated, and for SRC, we through documentation chose the providers, and so we did not require an on-site assessment. And we also, in SRC, did stress more family partnerships, especially family partnerships that were geared towards serving low-income families. And in Parent Aware, that's not a distinct requirement, although it is certainly part of a parent aware rating. So I just wanted to point those out. So who are the SRC participating child care programs? They are 14 programs, and there's a nice map, I think, in your packet of where they're located. It's on page 14 of the report, but I believe you should have a separate handout, and hopefully you might have gotten the color version. It shows that there are 9 centers and 5 child care homes located in 5 metro locations and in 9 non-metro locations. So we've got programs from St. Louis County to Lyon County to Southern Minnesota and Albert Lee and in everywhere kind of in between. So it was kind of we were successful, we felt, in doing recruitment and getting a broad representation of providers to participate.
Can I ask you, so you put out an RFP through the Child Care Association, or how did they know to apply, and then they applied and you picked 14? How many applied?
41.
41 and you picked 14.
Mm-hmm.
And how did they get the word that this was available?
We worked hard. We sent notices to various child cares, all the child care associations, the MNACI, MLFCCA, all the places where they have contacts with providers, the Child Care Network, Resource and Referral Network did a good job of getting it out.
The RFP went through the prescribed state RFP process, and it was published in the State Register, and then we made people aware that the State Register had something in it to look at.
Okay.
We hosted a video conference encouraged people to apply and tried
Thank
to
you.
Make it accessible. So.
Good.
And later I'll talk about the value of having school readiness connections connected to a quality rating system, because then that does some of the work of us knowing who the high quality providers are. So who was selected? A little bit more specific about the characteristics of the providers selected. Two Head Start grantees were selected who expanded their capacity to serve low-income families by accessing this program. Four Head Start partnerships, actually five at the beginning, were in Head Start partnerships, and one of them, what we found during the course of the project, is that Head Start partnerships are where Head Start grantee has an agreement with a Head Start partner to serve low-income families, and some of them are CCAP families, but some of them are not. And because some federal regulations made that more challenging during the course of this project, one program did have to drop their partnership. But for those that did retain it, they talked about the value of having SRC funds to continue the high level of services that they were offering, because without that, they wouldn't have been able to continue doing that. So again, these programs all expanded their capacity and served more children than they otherwise would have without these dollars. One Head Start or one center is NACE accredited. All five of the family child care programs that applied had at least a CDA credential. And I want to say that because many of those were the ones in Head Start partnerships, that all the work and preparation that had been done with building the capacity, in especially in outstate areas, to get those providers prepared to, for instance, do child assessment and have use of curriculum, paid off, because those were the programs that were ready to apply to SRC, because we were choosing programs that already had these components in place. And that now they are required to be rated by Parent Aware, as we mentioned before. Four of them have a rating. Three of them had a rating already because they happen to be in the pilot areas. Again, many of these are in counties outside of the pilot area, so those 10 are in process, and they're currently getting prepared for their on-site assessments. And one of the programs was in a place in Hennepin County where they got added into Parent Aware after Hennepin County did an expansion. So they're at various points, but well on their way to the Parent Aware rating.
You have about five more minutes, okay. And I know we have a provider so from St. Cloud, so we want to make sure we give her enough time.
The costs of SRC are the costs that are above the regular CCAP, what normally would be the CCAP payment. And so that includes, it's $2,870 a year. If you were paying a full year for a child in SRC, that's how much it would cost per child on an annual basis. And that includes the 25% higher maximum that's paid, that would have been paid for through CCAP. It also includes an amount that is factored for the 13% of children that could take advantage of the continuity of care policies that allowed for more flexibility and for children to continue to be authorized on a weekly basis. All right, how were SRC funds used? They were used to promote family partnerships. They were used to improve teaching materials and strategies. And again, these were programs that were already doing these things but were able to maintain or even improve what they were already doing. Sites use it for teacher training and education to monitor and assess children and provide referrals, including preschool screenings. And that was also a requirement of providers in SRC. I want to talk a little bit about work sampling, because we use that as a means to do, as a component of the evaluation. We used, all the programs were trained early in the project, and their staff attended 2 days of work sampling training. They loved it. I want to say that was one of the outcomes that we found in the evaluation, was staff loved the training and they loved using the assessment.
Was it was it the same as a school readiness assessment?
It was modified slightly. We took a few of the checklist items out just because it was so large and we wanted to narrow down what we were doing a little bit for the project, but it was a modified version of work sampling used for the MDE.
Okay.
And that's partially why we chose it, because at least that's a well-known assessment in the state of Minnesota. It was used for 3 and 4-year-olds. when we look at the results of the 50 children, only because this is a subset of a subset, 364 children, but only so many were age 4 at the time that when we needed to do assessments, and because it was only 19 months, that was the number that could be used for the evaluation purposes. So I really want to qualify the data because it's a very small sample, but 50 children, and that's the results that we're going to look at next. Because this appears very hopeful, I want to really caution you that we're not at all claiming that SRC programs have these outcomes with children, but we do want to say that these were the results of the 4-year-olds who did get assessments, and that 92% of them were proficient in physical and health in the physical and health domain, 82% personal social, 78% language and literacy, and 72% mathematical thinking. Again, caution you, these children were in these programs sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 years. These adults knew them very well, different lengths of time, and again, we're not attributing it directly to the services of the program, but wanted to share with you what the results were.
Yeah, good results, well above the 50% see for statewide. Good. Well, if you probably have 2 minutes now.
Okay. So I think even maybe somewhat impressive, other than the data, was really, again, how people talked about the benefits of work sampling, observing children more effectively, communicating with parents about child's progress. It gives people tools, creating customized goals for children, and integrating those results into their daily activities. And that's what the providers told us about how they used work sampling. So a little bit about SRC administration. Again, it utilizes existing county structure, so providers don't have to do separate billing to get paid for this amount that they got under SRC. Parents did not have to apply separately. They were informed of the slight differences of CCAP and regular SRC, and they could choose not to participate, and I think maybe one did. It was a very small number. Let's see. I just want to recap how the goals and results compared. We did find that some children, and again, that was the 13% of the children that benefited from some continuity. Parents were highly satisfied with the quality of their child's learning and the project. Programs engaged in many quality improvement activities, and parents and programs overall viewed the project as well managed. And just some future things to think about as we are considering how these things link to other early care and education efforts. This project, again, supported school readiness well using the existing infrastructures. Parents that we believe that choosing SRC programs in the future, that having a QRIS-like parent aware is essential to understanding where programs are and what their quality level is around the state. And the one thing that we think is unique about SRC is that it serves at-risk children by linking that CCAP payment to working families and still focusing on school readiness.
Thank you. And members, we're going to have this, the allowances, and the scholarships reports, and they're all in their own way unique. So I'd like to hear from the provider, and if there are some quick questions, or hear from the other two reports and then kind of take questions on everything. I hope you all are able to stay through the end of the hearing. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kristen Vosberg. I'm the director at Campus Playhouse Child Care Center at the St. Cloud Technical College, and we are an SRC provider. From the beginning of the SRC project till now, we've served approximately 55 children through the SRC project. We have more children enrolled that don't qualify for the CCAP. Currently, we have 19 children participating in SRC. Some of the children have graduated from our center and gone on to kindergarten. Others have moved and for a variety of reasons may have left our center. I'll just give some things about the families and things I've heard the families say about the SRC project, and that some families wouldn't be able to attend a quality center if it weren't for the SRC monies that pay the difference between what our rate is and what the maximum rate that the county can pay us. Especially if they have more than one child enrolled. paying that difference for more than one child would become overwhelming for them, and not they wouldn't be able to pay that. There, consistency is beneficial for children, and the children who are able to attend SRC centers have more consistency in their lives, I believe. Consistency of the staff who care for the children, the routines that we provide for them, the environment that they come to. If a family was not able to bring their child to our center, they possibly would be bounced from any family member or friend who may be able to take care of the child at that time, therefore not having the consistency in the child's lives. Families participating in SRC, as was mentioned before, have to have at least 25 hours of attendance to remain enrolled in SRC. And the parents have been very good about maintaining that 25 hours because they want to remain part of the SRC project, so they don't have to pay those differences in the rates. They're approved to come for up to 50 hours a week, and that would allow the parents time to be able to take care of personal business after they're finished with their school or their work or whatever it may be. So when they pick their child up from the center, they're ready to spend quality family time together. We also do work sampling assessments on the children, and it's a good thing to do that. We're able to identify if there's any areas of needs for the children, and then plan activities on our lesson plans accordingly to what those needs may be of the children. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions for that? We appreciate you came down from St. Cloud, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so you have 55 kids in the program overall, and then how many are in SRC, or was it 55 in?
There was 55 served from the time we began SRC through now. Currently, there are 19 attending that are part of SRC.
And what do you think is the biggest difference that SRC made for center, for the kids?
For the kids, the consistency part, that they've been able to remain with the same provider while they've, you know, some of them started in the infant room and now they've moved on to the toddler and preschool classroom, and they've been able to remain in our care with consistency for those children and the families, and peace of mind for the parents.
Right. Well, thank you. If you can stick around, maybe they're up in the back or so. What we're going to do is proceed with our next testimony and see if there's questions, if the members want to do any kind of comparison between the three. What I'd like to do is have Rob Grunewald and Scott McConnell come up at the same time. What I'd like to, so we don't run out of time, is have you each do your presentation and then take questions afterwards, if we could do that. We would start with Rob Grunewald. Do you have a PowerPoint you need to set up? So it's going to take you a few minutes here.
Moments.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you coming. I know it's been not easy to schedule. We'll let you get set up here. Members, Tuesday is going to be a very important hearing. We have a number of bills up. They are bills we will be passing out of the committee, not rolling into the bill like we usually do, so it'll be important for everyone to be here. And Thursday, we're doing the funders agenda. There are funders that have come up with a strategic long-range plan on early childhood, and so we're going to be talking about some of the things they're interested in, one of which is assessment, and some bills that are going to be introduced. I know Representative Norris is going to carry one of the bills, which is on a report card for early childhood readiness. So there's going to be some exciting initiatives a week from today we're going to talk about as well. Are you ready?
Just about.
Almost.
Okay. We're ready.
All right. That was pretty fast. Oh, but it's not coming up on the screen.
I did my...
Okay. Yeah. Let's see if we can get you going. Do you you want to start? Yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. And I know you've been here before. We appreciate you coming.
Mm-hmm. Rob Grunewald, Associate Economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis.
We did have to recognize that the rock star is here from the Federal Reserve, Art Rolnick, if you want to wave. We're glad to see you. Usually he would be testifying, so now he said he's observing Rob, or they're doing it in partnership, I suppose, if questions come up, that type of thing.
Sure.
And so we're glad you're here too, Art.
Great.
Go ahead.
First, to start out, these are my own comments, not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
And what I'm going to be providing you today is an update of the scholarship program, the St. Paul Early Childhood Scholarship Program, which is funded by the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. This is a mid-program update. We're about halfway through. It started in January 2008 when the first scholarship was issued and will be ending in August 2011. I've been serving on an implementation team and also on a policy team to watch over the project that has been going. And I'm providing you information from administrative data and also data from SRI International, which is the evaluator of the scholarship program. Just a little bit of background, and I think you've got copies of the slides, so we could go with the copies of the slides too. A little background, Art Rolick, Director of Research, as noted, and I got involved with research looking at the economic benefits of investing in early childhood education. Finding those benefits have a very high public return, as high as 16% annually adjusted for inflation. We released that paper first in January 2003. After a couple of years of being involved with this issue, we began asking the question, well, what is the best way to invest in early childhood, and how might a couple of economists weigh in on this issue? So we wrote a paper which we provided a proposal, and that proposal is to call for a system in which scholarships are provided to low-income children, which we call high-return children, in which they can attend a high-quality early learning program beginning at the age of three. It would also be coupled with information and also parent mentors, and that the parent mentor system could begin as early as prenatal. As we stepped back and we looked at the early childhood market and recognized that largely the early childhood market is a private market. 80% of the dollars in that market come from parents paying tuition for their children to attend childcare or preschool. About 20% comes from the public sector, from the federal government paying Head Start and child care subsidies, and also from the state government and public schools paying for some preschool funds. So by providing the scholarships, we'd be able to increase access to these high-return children, and because they can only be used at high-quality programs, it would provide an incentive for programs to improve their quality in order to receive these scholarship funds when the children attend. Furthermore, the programs would be competing for these kids, so they'd be focused on the outcome of school readiness, doing the best for getting kids ready for school. And the goals of the program are threefold. School readiness, so kids are ready by kindergarten. Parent engagement. When parents are provided with a scholarship, they're empowered with resources to make a choice of where their child can go. And in the model, we emphasize the sense of getting parents involved in their child's education. And last, increasing the number of high-quality openings at early childhood programs so that the system of early childhood programs would increase in quality. The administration of the St. Paul Scholarship Program includes the City of St. Paul. The City of St. Paul provided overall coordination and marketing to parents and the community. Resources for child caring, which is part of Minnesota's network of child care resource and referral networks. They provided referral assistance, application and scholarship payment processing. St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health monitored and administrated the parent mentoring component. Minnesota Early Learning Foundation provided the funds. And as I mentioned, SRI International is conducting the evaluation. The eligibility for the scholarships include simply the residents living in Frogtown, North End, and for one of the cohorts of children, the Payne-Phelan neighborhood was also opened up for eligibility. The income level is 185% of poverty or below. The children could enter at age three, which in that case they'd receive the scholarship, or if an expectant mother or a mother with a young infant could also enter that program and receive the parent mentoring. This way we have a system that goes from prenatal all the way through kindergarten. The pilot time frame, as I mentioned, was January 2008 through August 2011. This is a map of the pilot area. And I also note that last year, due to the economic downturn, MELF's fundraising prospects were reduced, and so they did have to reduce their overall budget for their foundation by 36%. This resulted in some program changes. First of all, the parent mentoring component of the program was eliminated by July 1st of the last year. EC programs that do not charge tuition, such as Head Start and school-based programs, were no longer provided the full amount of the scholarship. Instead, they received a small administrative fee. And also, the total number of children had to be kept. But the goal in making these changes was to keep the total number of children in the program at a level that we could still have a high-quality evaluation, get some information about how this pilot would work. This chart shows the ethnicity of children who are enrolled in the scholarship program back just over a year ago. That's when we had about 400 children involved, either in the parent mentoring component or in the scholarship component. As you can see, they're diverse. When the baseline survey conducted by Wilder Research was conducted prior to the scholarship program, it was noted that half of the children, young children in that area, came from families who are immigrants. It wasn't a surprise then that over half of the children in the program, or about half, had English, where some other language than English was their primary language spoken at home. Number of Korean children were involved in this pilot. 13% of those children come from homes in which Korean was the primary language. 71% had household income lower than 100% of poverty. And as a program administrator at RCC noted, it seems that this program is reaching those families that would not typically be involved with the formal early care and education system. This chart denotes that. This is the data here is from parent interviews conducted by SRI. We see that only a third of children prior to entering the scholarship program were in some type of formal child care preschool setting. This is data from February the past year, and shows the where children are attending. About half of the children are attending center-based programs that are for-profit or non-profit, full day. 7% are in family-based program. Overall, 30% of children are in Head Start, and most of them are in their full-day program. If we look at between full-day and half-day, it's 77% in full-day, 23% in half-day. The other piece of data that SRI is tracking is the number of high-quality openings in these neighborhoods at early childhood programs. And they noted that between September 2008 and September 2009, there was a 50% increase in the number of programs and a 33% increase in the number of openings, or what we call slots, in high-quality programs. So that there seems to be a relationship between having the quality rating system pilot, parent aware in that area, and also the availability of the scholarship dollars. And then turning to some of the findings from the SRI interviews, which they had parent interviews but also focus groups, they noted that there was an increased support and awareness of high-quality early childhood programs among parents and the community generally. Looking at the implementation, it overall went pretty well, recognizing that as a pilot, the plane was being built as it was flying at some times. At this point, the plane is built and is flying quite well. Challenges include transportation. Many families have difficulty having transportation or take their child to the program of choice. In terms of recruitment, we found that broad-based recruitment efforts did not work as well. It's more on-the-ground, person-to-person recruitment efforts. In fact, in the last round of recruitment, we found that having an outreach person go door-to-door was particularly helpful. And also integrating those programs that don't charge tuition into the program continues to be an area that we're trying to find that best way to do it. For example, Head Start and public school-based preschool programs don't charge a fee. And so when a parent receives a scholarship, they ask, well, what am I going to do with the scholarship relative to these programs? For some time, these programs, Head Start and the St. Paul Public School programs, did receive the full scholarship amount, could use those dollars to increase quality, increase other slots, and also duration of programming. And when parents were asked directly about their responses to the program, they were generally enthusiastic about the program. They consider it user-friendly, especially those that have some experience with the CCAP program. The participation provided some school and work opportunities, since the especially those children who are in full-day programs, that care and education was relatively consistent. And for those that had the parent mentoring, that there was generally strong support and opinions about the information that they were receiving from the parent mentors. So the lessons that are in progress, and we'll continue to learn more over the next 2 years, is that there are more children in this neighborhood enrolled in high-quality programs. Parents are involved in their children's education, and that there's an increase in spaces at high-quality programs. The next step for SRI is to have some child outcome information in which they're doing some child assessments. Finally, I'll leave you with my contact information and some important websites.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is proceed with allowances and then take questions on both of those. We need a minute for technical. Is that, while we're transitioning here, is this the last year?
It has another 20 months.
20 months or so. Okay.
21 months. Thank you. It's August 11th. Okay. 18 months. 19 months.
Well, welcome to the committee. Yeah, if you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Scott McConnell. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, but today I'm speaking on behalf of Donna Spiker and Erica Gaylor from SRI International in Palo Alto. It was easier to get me here than them. And so I have, through my work at the university, have participated in several of the evaluation activities for the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, and have had the privilege of being the primary contact, technical contact for Dr. Spiker and her team, and so have been involved in the allowance evaluation, and they asked me to fill in for them today, and so I will try and do them well by this. What I'm going to do today very briefly is talk about the history and background of the allowances program, give you a very fast cut at the evaluation questions that were considered, talk about some of the major findings, and leave you with a couple of the implications that Donna and her team thought were particularly relevant. The allowances program was created by the legislature and signed by the governor in 2007. It was originally funded at the level of $6 million, but about $330,000 was brought out of it before it was actually implemented. It was administered in three regions throughout the state by Resources for Child Caring in St. Paul, by Hennepin County in North Minneapolis and Wayzata, and by the Minnesota Valley Action Council in Blue Earth and Nicollet counties. The MELF agreed to fund the evaluation of this program, and so that brought about my involvement, and SRI was selected to do that evaluation. The allowances were created to provide up to $4,000 per year for children over an 18-month period. They were intended to be used to pay parent fees in high-quality programs. I'll be telling you about that in just a second, to do one of two things, either to increase the number of slots in those programs or the length of time that children could spend in them, or to increase the quality that those programs had in place for young kids. Families to be eligible for receipt of the allowances had to be at or below 185% of the federal poverty guidelines. The child had to be 3 or 4 years of age, and they had to reside in one of the three parent-aware pilot areas because the programs, as you'll see in a second, needed to be parent-aware participants. The programs had to have either a 3 or 4 star rating in the parent-aware rating system, be a Head Start program or a nationally accredited program by the National Association for Education of Young Children or other professional organizations, or have a provisional rating from either the Department of Education or the Department of Human Services. These were essentially the programs that were deemed to be of high quality in early care and education. I should also mention that the programs were only provided to children that were citizens or legal immigrants of the United States. This is a chart that gives you a sort of a quick picture of how the dollars were spent. A couple of quick points. First, it was about $3.9 million that got allocated through the three dark boxes. About 53% of the total funds were spent in St. Paul, about 32% in Hennepin County, and about 15% in Blue Earth and Nicollet County. It should be noted, too, that some of these allowances were part of the scholarship programs that Rob was just talking about. So there were places where children were enrolled in the scholarship program but were also recipients of the allowances. That accounted for about, 15% of the total funds. There were a number of evaluation questions. I think the most important things to point out are that there wasn't enough time. This was a fairly short-lived program, nor sufficient funds to do direct assessments of the children or observations of the programs. So most of these findings are the results of either administrative data or interviews. The focus was on how the funds changed both children's placements and the services that the programs that they were attending provided. The sources of information for the evaluation included interviews with both parents and providers, data pulled from the application forms that the parents completed, program end-of-project evaluations that were completed, particularly about how they expended the funds, and quarterly fiscal reports that were provided by the program serving kids. A little bit of information about the children. Over 1,100 children participated. 973 of them received, at least for this perspective, only allowances. They also received other subsidies in many instances. But 174 of the total kids participated in the scholarship program. Of the 973 that were allowance-only children, as you can see, about half of them were in St. Paul, about a third in Hennepin County, and about 15% in Blue Earth and Nicollet counties. The children were, as intended, 3 and 4 years of age primarily. They would have turned 5 if they enrolled in the program when they were program eligible or age eligible, and then got older, as they do, before these data were collected. The ethnicity represents, I think, pretty closely the diversity that Rob was talking about just a moment ago. And in this particular case, about 70% of the kids spoke English by parent report at home. We don't have information about ethnicity or home language for about 15 to 18% of the kids. The families, as you can see, were somewhat varied in their characteristics because of the eligibility requirements. You can see that a lot of the number of families with low income was relatively high, parent education relatively low, and many of the families, about a third, were single and had been single during the time that they were raising these children. A little more information about the families. Participants in other subsidy programs supporting family resources. Where were the kids? This is a chart that I think summarizes across the settings. There's another chart that will be a little more helpful in a second. 97 early childhood programs and a total of 141 sites. So a Head Start program might participate but have multiple classrooms involved. Of those 97 programs, 68 of them were center-based early childhood ed programs, about half of them for-profit and about half of them non-profit. There were 21 family child care programs, and then 5 school district programs and 3 Head Start grantees that had various parts of their services included in the receipt of allowances. To understand this chart, you have to think about the question that was being answered. The question that was answered was, how did your child's placement change as a function of receiving the allowances? So about a third of the children who received allowances, so that's about 300 children, were not in any early childhood education program before the parents received the allowances and began a program after their receipt. About 16% of them moved to a different early childhood ed program, and about a half of them stayed in the same program. How the program spent their funds, generally, about almost 60% of the funds were spent for children's fees, so paying for the kids' time or for services directly provided to the children. Pardon me, and about 42% for quality improvement, and I'm going to break that down in just a moment. Quick note here that you'll see that about a fifth of the kids, 18%, the allowances were used to increase the time that they spent in these high-quality programs. So that would be, to put it in different terms, increasing their dosage of exposure to high-quality early education services. So of the 42% that was spent on quality improvement, what do we know about that? That about half of it was spent on the purchase of curriculum materials and other learning materials that would be used with the kids in the programs. There was also funding for professional development, for training, for other quality improvements. But Donna emphasized to me several times, I think, what she thinks is the most important part of this slide, and that is that while these are the funds that were expended by programs because they received allowances for some of the children that they were enrolling, these are enhancements that would have affected all of the kids in the program. So the curriculum materials that were in place, the additional training that the teachers received, that was spread across all of the kids, whether they had received allowances or not.
Dr. McConnell, some reason we don't have a copy of all the slides, so one, I wanted to ask if you will send this to us.
We will, absolutely.
So we can get it to the committee members. Also, if we go back and refer to slides, which I may do, I would have to have you flip through
okay.
and find
my
the
My apologies item. For not getting the complete
okay.
deck to you.
Okay.
As I mentioned, the allowances were layered or braided with other funds. In about a third of the cases, or quarter of the cases, the allowances were the only public subsidy monies that were identified by the programs being used by individual families. But you can see that about 130 families were also using CCAP dollars. There were school district funds, Head Start funds. So there were a variety of other things. I think by intent, the allowances were seen as a supplement. I think this chart suggests that that's, in fact, exactly how they were used. Parent program and stakeholder experiences, very briefly, there's quite a lot of information. There's a fuller report as well, a text report that we can make available to the committee. The parents were very positive about this program. 70 to 90% varied by the question, found the applications easy to submit, found the program easy to understand, felt that they had a fairly easy job finding or keeping a program for their child. So generally, I think the parents were very, very satisfied with what they found. The programs saw benefit in the allowances, both in terms of increasing access, that is, either expanding the amount of time that they could serve children or expanding the number of children that they could serve, but also in terms of being able to improve the quality of services that they provided. A number of the providers did talk about the confusion of administering allowance dollars with CCAP dollars, and I'll come back to that when I talk about the implications. That was really sort of one of the only expressed concerns from the programs. The agencies, particularly the Departments of Human Service and Education, which were the state agencies responsible for the allowances, reported a number of positive effects for both the programs and for the families that they served. As I mentioned, there are several challenges. This was a program like the School Readiness Connections that went from idea to implementation very, very quickly. A lot of people, including several in this room, worked very hard on getting this program up and running. And in doing anything complex and anything complex and speedy, I think that there are challenges in doing that. There were also a few challenges in trying to understand how to use this $4,000 per child to both increase resources for the child, time or slots, but also to use the dollars for quality enhancement. The programs were, you know, they thought that was one pot of money, and it was a little hard for them to think about how to split it into two different purposes. And then, as I mentioned, there was some difficulty in coordination with CCAP. The qualifications or the eligibility requirements are somewhat different. And in fact, you could even argue that the goals are somewhat different. So there were instances where kids might be eligible for CCAP when they received the allowances, might lose their CCAP eligibility, but still have the allowances available to them. That was a source of confusion for both programs and parents. There was an initial challenge. This program came online just as the parent aware of a rating system was coming online as well. So there was an initial challenge in finding programs that were eligible given the 3- and 4-star criteria that the program had. And with that, I will leave you with Donna's contact information. I'm happy to try to answer questions, but with the chair, we have also arranged to make sure that Donna can answer any hard questions in writing for the committee very quickly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, it was a lot of information on three different programs, really, and trying, I think, as our role as legislators is trying to figure out from your evaluations, from a policy, what the policy implications are, and how, as legislators, we then implement good policy. Are there questions? And I would start out maybe with that. I would have a question on the policy implications, especially around allowances. If, you know, are they big enough? Are they really making an impact? I don't know if you can say that from the evaluation, but would more money make an impact? Should we target them better? Should we have them available for quality, or should we just say they're for slots? I mean, I think that's a policy question that we are wondering. And if it's going to interfere with CCAP, I mean, or have some complications, I wonder if there's a different way we could do it. As the members probably know, that this was not funded. Some people consider this program in hibernation, that it may come back out, and if it's going to come back out of hibernation whenever we get back in the black in the state, might be a few years from now, but how could we do this better? And I think that's part of what evaluation helps us to do. Any comments on that, Dr. McConnell?
That I admire and appreciate the hard work you all do about setting policy, and hope that what I say will inform your decision making. There were a lot of questions in there, Madam Chair. I think one of the things that we notice is that the time-limited nature of the program did have some effect. I think different than what we're noticing in the scholarship evaluation, but this was, as I mentioned, a fairly short-lived program. I believe from probably the first dollar spent until the end, it was about 18 months. You know, interestingly, if you remember that chart where how the quality dollars were spent, some of those quality enhancements, perhaps sort of foreshadowing stimulus funds, probably have enduring effects. So to train teachers that hopefully stay in the setting, or to purchase new curriculum or instructional materials that are hopefully enduring, that those are effects that programs can continue to use after this program has gone offline. It's sort of separate from this evaluation, but just personally, my experience is that the funding streams and the eligibility criteria that come with those funding streams are complicated, and I think that managing the complexities of that system are at least challenging for the folks that have to do it, parents, programs, and administrators. And at some point, I think complexity probably affects sort of impact. I don't know if we've achieved that level yet. It may be that it's just complex, but where everybody's getting along fine. It also seems sometimes, though, that complexity does restrict some people's participation or change the rates of uptake over time.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the fiscal agent. First of all, who was the fiscal agent for each of the programs? I assume there was one, and then what were their roles and responsibilities in terms of oversight of how the dollars were used? And finally, how effective do you think they were? Do you have one model that you think might be better than the others? Have you had a chance to look at that?
And you both had fiscal agents. Who wants to address that?
I can start.
Okay.
Mr. So the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation is the fiscal responsibility. They have the oversight of the scholarship program and set policy around the scholarship program, that is, determining eligibility, how those funds will be distributed to programs. And so I think the advantage of having the MELF as a fiscal agent is that they had some flexibility they were able to put that program into place fairly quickly, considering that they themselves are going to be time limited as of ending on December 2011. They want all of the information gathered from their various pilots in by that time. From my perspective, because I sat on the policy group that helped determine, you know, how the fund should be spent, who would be eligible, and so on, I felt that there was solid oversight. We were able to work with the resources for child caring in terms of being able to ensure that those dollars are distributed to the programs according to the children who attended those programs, and to make it as efficient as possible. And I think that there's lessons learned from the pilot that can also get some information on how to blend those dollars with child care assistance dollars, how they fit with other programs that have other public sources of funds, and so on.
Dr. McConnell, it was different for the allowances, right? If you can talk about the fiscal agents.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, my understanding, and there are several people in the room who will correct me if I'm wrong, is that the fiscal agents for the allowances were local entities. So in St. Paul, it was Resources for Child Caring. In Hennepin County, it was Hennepin County. In Blue Earth and Nicollet County, I believe it was a CAP agency, right? And so there was a relationship between each of those entities and DHS, where I believe the money flowed. Those agencies worked with DHS to develop the application processes and the reporting procedures, and then the fiscal agents worked with local providers to make sure that the allowances were, that eligible kids completed applications, eligibility was determined, and then funds flowed.
Representative Peterson, follow up.
So, did you Was there consistency with each of those agencies that had that responsibility? Were some more efficient than others? I mean, I got some feedback and some concerns about at least one of the agencies, and I'm that had that responsibility. So that's why I'm asking. Mm-hmm. And anyway, maybe you can respond to that.
Dr. McConnell?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I can't. I simply don't have the information. I will try and find out. My recollection is that it is in the full report, and I'll try and gather that up and get it to you as quickly as I can.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you again, Madam Chair. It just seems to me, I mean, it could be, the fiscal agent could be a city, it could be a county, it could be a school district. And I think that's an important piece to look at in the future because, and depending again on the responsibility, and I don't know the job description that they had and what kind of oversight they had from any other group and how closely they worked with these folks. But, you know, there needs to be some insight, it seems to me, about how the system works with, particularly with the schools. But I think just in general, they need to know about early childhood, about how the system works, and some of the agencies may have little or no knowledge of that area. So just something to think about in the future.
Dr. McConnell, that's what I think. There's concern that the fiscal agents were so different, you know, and how to, and as policymakers again, would it be to a benefit of the program to have more similarities, or how what would be the policy implications of the pilots for structuring a different system? So if you want to talk with Ms. Spiker about that, that would be great. Representative Peterson, we hope you're feeling better. We know you had eye surgery, so that's why she's wearing the dark glasses.
Madam Chair, I'm not trying to be exotic or incognito.
We just wanted to clarify that.
I did try to go some of the day without, but I actually had to go run over to the eye doctor and get something. He said, put the glasses back on for a day.
Okay. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As at least Mr. Grunewald knows, I continue to struggle with this format, not the outreach and the, you know, having the students most in need getting early childhood. And now that you're one more year into it, we've had this discussion before, I want my same question answered, which is, what is better about this than doing the outreach, making sure that the people who aren't participating get their door knocked on, or some very direct and helpful way to lure them in to have early childhood quality, early childhood for their children, and having the quality ratings system that we're working on, and then funding sliding fee child care, Head Start, school readiness, and ECFE so there aren't waiting lists. So why, now that you're one further year into this, is this better than that?
Mr. Grunewald?
Okay. Well, Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, I would say, you know, to bring up one analogy, if we, the monies that are in child care for sliding fee, if they were focused on the child in terms of eligibility, focused on school readiness for that child, and also were tied to quality, that in itself would have a system that would tied to quality, that in itself would have a system that would ensure that children are consistently in early childhood programs focused on getting them ready for kindergarten. But that system is not focused in that direction. I think that using a scholarship system like this one ensures that parents have a number of choices, not only the programs that be funded in the nonprofit or for-profit sectors, but also the public programs. And it utilizes all of the infrastructure that is available in early care and education. As I mentioned in the beginning of my comments, most of the infrastructure in early care and education is within child care programs and preschool programs that currently exist in this more private market. And a scholarship system is a way to leverage those resources and increase access for high return kids and get them into quality programs.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grunewald, what changes would you like to see that you said the others aren't doing what you're talking about to make them that way, or do you see that as not able to ever happen and hence you want to go this route, which I see has other problems with it?
Mr. Grunwald?
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, the other programs, just to be sure, referring to the non-fee-based programs, Head Start, public schools, school readiness funds, and so on. See, the other analogy that I would point to is that the market for early care and education is similar to higher education, where we do have programs in the public sector that are supported by public dollars. So if we use that analogy, we have public school preschools, such as St. Paul Public School programs, other school districts that offer preschool. We have Head Start. And those programs continue to be funded. What the scholarships provide is the opportunity for parents to choose and use those funds not only among the public programs, but also the programs in the for-profit and nonprofit sectors. So in the analogy of higher education, you're then able to provide a variety of choices and bring that whole market up to speed. The last point I'll make is that it's a flexible system. That is, with the funding stream coming through a parent's choice, school districts, Head Start centers, child care programs, preschool programs can position themselves how they would like to relative to that funding stream. They can look at the market, determine how many new classrooms that they would like to build, how they would like to access those markets of funds.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this my last question. So you said that the having these makes things more flexible. Parents who don't have means can choose private things and not just public things, and so there's the choice. But I'm trying to get straight what you said in your first answer, which was there was something that wasn't as good about the systems, like the sliding fee, school readiness, that they're not doing the job right, or you don't think they could. What was that? I can't remember what you said, but that's what I wanted to explore more.
Sure.
Mr. Grunwald?
Sure. I'll clarify that point. The point is that for, let's say, a Head Start Center in a public school-based program, where they are funded to provide service for a number of kids, their budget is set way in advance. That is, in March, February, they're projecting how much service they're going to be providing children that upcoming fall, and that's when their recruitment happens. I mean, their system is not set up like a for-profit or nonprofit preschool or child care program that is continually having to look at that market and determine how many kids are we going to have it at any given moment. And so in working with Head Start and the public school programs with the scholarship pilot, that was our discussion. It's two different modes of being able to use those funds. What I've found is that the thing that limits our pilot to be able to study this in depth is the time-limited nature. It's only going to go through August 2011, and it's relatively smaller scale. I'd point to another scholarship pilot that is a program, it's not even a pilot, Denver Public Schools, the whole city of Denver has a scholarship program that provides scholarships to all families for children that are 4 years old. And it's a sliding-based program tied to quality, so we're getting closer. Mm-hmm. And there they've been able to integrate the public programs, that is Head Start and the public school programs, into that funding stream. They have formulas to be able to determine how much public resources they have towards those kids, and if they want to access the dollars, they just show, well, we don't have enough dollars to provide service for these kids, so we're going to use the Denver Public School Scholarship or the Denver Scholarship Funds to do that. So there's some other models that we can learn from. And the last point that I'll make is that a number of state-funded preschool programs do offer choice among child care programs, preschool programs, both in a public and a private sector, such as Georgia. And for example, a family in Georgia is given a choice between these programs if they meet the quality threshold to send their child at the age of 4 to a preschool program. So it's not too dissimilar from a scholarship program, an allowance program. There are differences. There's more flexibilities in these two models. And we do call them a scholarship or an allowance.
So, Representative Greiling.
Oh, Madam Chair, if other people are on the list, you don't have to keep. I could actually set up an appointment and talk more because I've got more questions. But so it sounds to me then, Madam Chair, Mr. Grunewald, that the Head Start, they're just fat and sassy because they have their set enrollment, so they don't go out and that's all they have, and if they filled it and they know they have waiting lists, they don't bother to go look for any more. But I would contend that's a function of the waiting list. You know, if they had the ability to take all the kids in that neighborhood and they didn't have a waiting list, and somehow we found out how many kids there were that were eligible, that were low income, and then we scouted around, knocked on all the doors, found those kids, and they could take them all, then that would not be, to me, the Head Start having a limited number of slots, and then those slots are filled, it's not their fault that they're not beating the bushes for more, because why would they find any more when they don't have any more slots? So I guess I would argue that that wouldn't be a problem with Head Start. It's a problem with our waiting list and the fact that we decide how many kids we're going to fund and how many we're not, and then they're on the waiting list. So I still think that if you had scholarships for all kids, or you had outreach, quality, no waiting lists and sliding fee, and you beat the bushes to find the kids, that we'd be talking apples and apples, and it wouldn't matter which one you had. The only difference would be if you wanted the poor families to be able to choose the private options. And as the K-12 person who's looked into vouchers a lot, I don't notice that vouchers ever cover, except for the Catholic schools and schools like that, the full tuition. Usually they want that voucher and they want to charge more, which then still cuts out the poor families. And for the Catholic schools that are private, they're very good on outreach, taking everybody, but they kick kids out and so forth, and don't have to keep them like the public schools do. So I never think it's apples to apples. And I know you want to compare to higher ed and not to K-12, but I guess I'm comparing it to K-12 because I see early childhood. I wouldn't want to see little kids get scholarships or allowances and then they still couldn't go to some expensive preschool, because that wasn't enough money and they didn't have enough to make up the difference. And if we make the allowances or scholarships, I can never remember which one is the big one and which one is the small one. He's the big one? Okay. All right, that's why I'm talking to him. I knew there was a reason I was talking to him. Then we price ourselves out of covering all kids. You know, that's my other problem with that. I think until we cover all kids, we have to worry about covering all kids and not having Cadillac programs for some kids, and naturally they're going to be happy and their parents are going to be happy and whoever accepts them into their public or private preschool or is going to be happy because there's money to be had. But I worry about having something that's wonderful but we hardly any kids get to do it. We couldn't even finish funding these pilots. And so how are we then going to make this statewide? Talk to me if you can.
I think what we'll do is we have a couple other questions. Because we started late, members, I'd like to go, if the testifiers can stay, another at least 5 minutes, 5 to 10 at the most, if that's okay. See if we get the questions answered. As you can see, there's numerous questions. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if we have more committee time somewhere along the way, but it might be interesting to advance this discussion further, because Representative Greiling just raised about 5 other questions in my own mind. But real quickly, if I could, Madam Chair, the mentoring component kind of got shut down in the middle. Did you see anything in terms of kind of efficacy or child outcomes or family outcomes, any difference or degradation after that?
Mr. Grunwald?
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, I'll make 2 comments about when the parent mentoring part ended in July 1st. First of all, SRI will be able to note through parent interviews the types of effects that the reduction of having the parent mentors on hand would have. Currently, what they say is that they do miss them and that they do appreciate the type of information that was provided. What we can look in the second comment would be is we can watch what attendance rates are, what attrition rates are in the program since July. And at this point, attrition hasn't been so bad. In other words, the attrition among the kids that started this fall has been relatively light. It's been about 5% up until this month. And so we've been retaining kids, which has been good. Also, Resources for Child Caring has stepped up their ability over the phone to provide referral service and stay connected to those families, even though they're not making the home visits like the parent mentors were. So there's likely to be effect that we'll see more of, but at this point, it seems like the program is still working well.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And then just to confirm, it seems like from all of the findings reports here, there was no real tracking of individual families or students and whether or not they actually kind of came out the back end of the pilots in a better position. The assumption, I think, if you can just confirm this, is that, okay, we got them into something called a quality environment, so we're assuming that the outcomes were there. Is that a fair statement? Was that kind of a built-in assumption to the pilot?
Mr. Grunewald?
Actually, no. There's going to be a very thorough investigation of child outcomes, and that'll be the next step of SRI's work, is to continue their individual assessment of children and then be able to compare them with a group of children from a different neighborhood that did not have access to the scholarships. So it's a relatively rigorous evaluation of some of the child outcomes.
And if I could, this one will be hopefully brief too. So we define this as a market, and yet I heard terms like luring and beating the bush to even identify people to use the scholarships. And then we kind of compiled a list of quality centers that they could go to. So do you feel like in this whole process that we really kind of vetted this concept of a true market, or is it a pretty highly coerced market? I mean, they couldn't just take the money and keep their kids at home, you know. So how far did we go in really testing the concept of a true market?
Mr. Grunewald? Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, one aspect of a market not working well is information. And so a big piece of the addressing the market failure of not having information to parents about the availability and, of course, the access to these early childhood programs required some effort. And what we'd like to say is, with a well-priced scholarship, and in terms of if a child went to a full-day program year-round, that would be worth $13,000 a year. And so we found that, yes, if you just walk up or send out a brochure that says, here's a scholarship valued in $13,000, that isn't enough. It takes some person-to-person work to explain what the program is. And once families learned about the program, how to use the scholarship dollars, then their enthusiasm peaked, and it seems to be continuing once their children are enrolled in programs. So information has been an important barrier in the market that the scholarship parent mentor model has been addressing.
Representative Downing, we have Representative Mariani still, and then we'll...
10-second comment. I mean, it's just interesting to compare that to the... $100 rebates for appliances that were overly subscripted within a 24-hour period. And anyway, it's interesting to see the difference at how hard we have to work to even just make people take advantage of it. So anyway, just an observation.
Mr. Grunewald, and then we'll go to Representative Mariani.
Just a clarification that the dollars only go to the programs. That is, the scholarship dollars were never given to the families and then paid to the programs. The programs are just reimbursed for a child's attendance at that program.
Representative Mariani?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm afraid to venture in because I only know enough to almost be dangerous here.
Okay.
I think Representative Greiley actually captured some of the big questions I have. I'm wondering whether we've looked at CCAP, because we know we have flexibility built into CCAP, and whether we've done a similar type of analysis based on the ability to exercise choice through CCAP, so that we can do some sort of apples-to-apples comparison here. I will note, unless I'm reading this wrong, on page 21, Exhibit 9, that you know, the percentage of the children who were in the same ECE program, different or no program, prior to the pre-K allowances project, so this gets us into the pre-K, you know, 16% difference choice there. And so the question, this is a very broad, you know, too long, you know, for the rest of our time, but, you know, is 16%, you know, a big enough kind of change potentially to even warrant, you know, adding yet another quote-unquote flexible, you know, tool here? I don't think we need answers here. These are just sort of broad questions that are going through my mind in terms of, you know, what's our best approach and where our best investments can be made. And I suspect that this body of work is going to require, and I echo Representative Downey. I don't know if you meant it tongue-in-cheek because Representative Brownlee threw out a number of issues here, but I think it does warrant more time for us than we're able to do in one hearing. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I think that that's probably the theme here is we need to think about how to get more information, help, again, the policy implications of both the allowance program and the scholarship program. As policymakers, as legislators who are in times of budget deficit, in times of difficult, you know, where's our best place to invest our money? We know that, of course, our enrollment is in the room, and we know it's in early childhood, but it's how you do that within early childhood. We, Representative Mariani, before I think it was before you came in, we had the School Readiness Connections Program. That's where they take CCAP money and give, I think it's a 25% differential above that. Add some quality elements to it. So part of it, you know, is do you take the current system, the CCAP system, and do something with that? Do you take, you know, full-time scholarships? Do you take part-time allowances? Members, I think this is a good discussion. I think it's, you know, as we look at how to best get kids to have a quality early childhood education, these are good questions to struggle with. And for me, I like to see the struggle. I think it makes it interesting as well as thoughtful, and hopefully, you know, the evaluation for, is it the scholarships, is going to come out in the fall, and we will be looking at the next legislative session for really any action, so we have some time here, but I do want to follow up, and we'll let you know how we can learn more about this. So anything else? With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.